Not the horrible swine flu, so you should be safe at least for now. My name is Eric. Last name is... I work at McMaster University. And probably you want to get a hold of me at some point, and you can of course try to email me on the perimeter account, but let me just give you my email at McMaster, which is one that I usually meet. It's very simple, it's just my last name and then McMaster.ca. So before we get started, now you know my name. So could we take a round? So just tell me your name and I'll try to make a best effort to remember all of them by the end of the previous. Let's just start here. Okay.
Eric.
Oh, excuse me, how many errors do you have? Okay. More difficult.
Who's it?
Miltanis.
Okay.
You mean?
Ross.
Okay. Darren. Joe.
Okay. Rosanna.
Okay.
Tom.
Sorin.
Joe.
Henry.
Bruno.
Lima.
Sorry.
Kyle.
Kyle, okay.
Chris.
Imogen.
Dan.
Alex.
Charlotte.
It's be somewhat of a challenge. What I'll be telling you about is scientific computing. This is something that I have been teaching for a number of years, and usually, whenever I teach a class like this, the background is going to be very varied. So some of you might know a lot of what I'll be telling you, some of you may not know anything. So we're going to start very basic, and then hopefully we're going to get up to speed rather quickly. I do hope that this is going to be a course that will allow you to relax a little bit. It shouldn't be very complicated. And I should say that is at the end, we are going to do some stuff that hopefully should be quite convenient for the other courses here. So let me just give you a little outline of what we'll be doing. Actually, before that, let me tell you something. The tutorial and what I'll be telling you about is going to be based on Fortran. And let me just give you one defense for this. So Fortran, first of all, is formula translation. So it's,
I think, the only scientific program that was, or programming language that was actually developed by scientists for the purpose of doing scientific calculations, and that's one of its virtues. The other thing is that this here is highly optimized, and it's something that you are going to appreciate later on if you start working with the programming language. It has been extensively modernized recently, so if you want to do most fancy things that you can do in other programming languages, then you can do them as well today in Fortran. So the new definitions of Fortran came in with Fortran 90, then 95, I guess 2003, and there's a proposed standard which is now 2008. So we're going to mainly focus on what became known as Fortran 90 because there is a significant time lag between a standard that's being processed, then the time when it's being adopted, and then finally whenever sort of extensions that was proposed, and instead it actually makes it into a working compiler. So, for instance, the 2003 extensions to Fortran, I'm not sure when you try it on the system that you will be, and you will be doing that for tutorials, then it may or may not be there. We can actually go and check on that.
Which version do you want to be there?
The G90? No, it should be the Fortran, Intel Fortran, which you call I4. So we can, there are differences between the various compilers. The one we'll be using is the Intel compiler, and on Proteus you can call it by I4, but we'll get to all these details, particularly for the tutorial this afternoon. Okay.
So that's good. But mainly one overwhelming reason why I like Fortran is if you do work in science, even though you may not even any time later touch on a programming language, eventually you're going to end up seeing Fortran code. All libraries, everything, it's based on Fortran, even the C++ libraries. It's sort of a hidden secret, the scientific ones, that is. So you will see it eventually. And then the other thing that I like about Fortran is that you can sort of get going rather easily. You don't have to read tons and tons of manuals, but you can actually write your first little program, hopefully this afternoon, if you haven't already. So it's a slow learning curve here. But so, to the books here, the one book that you will be using is this one, that I hope that you were able to get hold of. Did anybody know?
There is a copy on the shelves.
Okay. Fight for it. There are many, many Fortran books. I kind of like this one because some of them try to be very pedagogical, so they're 2,000 pages, and you read and read and it doesn't go anywhere. This one you can use as a reference, and it's not incredibly expensive. I did put this down as a required book, but let me just write it. So it's by Ellis, your critics. It explains Fortran in nice detail, and it's good to have around if you want to have a look at what's how to program in Fortran. Then, if you do get carried away and don't hate Fortran before you're done with this course, then I just wanted to show you probably one of the best standards for it. So this is. This is the Fortran handbook, as it's called. Sometimes it's just called the handbook, and it's by a whole slew of people. It's Adams here, Brainerd, and the last guy is Smith. It's a Springer book, by the way. So this, I don't expect you to buy this, but if you want to go and look, if you come through something in Fortran that you don't understand, then this will, in all likelihood, have it explained in great detail. It's, however, almost impossible to read on its own because it is what it is. It's a handbook. So that's about Fortran here. We're going to talk quite a bit about computational physics and scientific computing. And the book that I recommend is, did anybody get hold of this book?
I don't pick up these books on the shelves that way.
Okay. it's good that my course doesn't rely a lot on the books that you for me. So this is a book by Pang.
It's just called Introduction to Computational Physics. Again, there are a great many books. They're quite varied because often they cover the author's interest, which might be in biological physics, might be in dynamical systems. So this one gives a nice survey, and it has some shortcomings, but I kind of like it anyway. Quite a few of the things that we're going to be talking about will be discussed in more detail in this book, at least it'll also give you references to other works that you can go and have a look at. The way the course is going to be working is that I'm going to lecture in the morning, of course, and then we're going to have tutorials in the afternoon. Most of the tutorials will be based on you solving some kind of problem on the computer. I hope that you have access and you know how to log on to ProTools. I hope that most of you brought your computer. Then we'll just see how it goes this afternoon, and then maybe we'll clear up a few things tomorrow. So the first two lectures, I'm going to attempt to explain to you everything there is about programming. So I'm going to do Fortran for two lectures under the assumption that at least you have heard about another programming language. Okay. So I'm not going to tell you about if then else statements and so forth. What I'm going to try to do is to show you the particularities of Fortran and how a basic program, what it looks like, how you compile it, and then where you go from there. We will actually touch upon quite some advanced features of Fortran, but it shouldn't be anything that should be all that challenging. Then after that, we're going to have fun here by looking at functions and series. Particularly, I'd like to tell you about errors in scientific computing, which is unfortunately unavoidable. You'll see how horrible wrong things can go if you don't think about what you're doing. We'll do a little bit of differentiation, integration, then look at linear algebra. Not very much, though, but just as a little illustration. Then we're going to switch over and we're going to look at eigenvalue problems, mostly because quite a few of the quantum problems that you're looking at can be formulated in some way as a matrix problem where you want to determine the eigenvalues of some matrix. And you're actually going to try to do this. So we're going to take a giant matrix and then figure out where the eigenvalues are. Then after that, we're going to be looking at differential equations. Of course, we're going to have to solve Schrodinger's equation. Then we're almost done. Except for we're going to move on to then what you really might call particular techniques that was developed in physics for simulating things, and that would be the Monte Carlo method. So I don't know how much you know about Monte Carlo, but we're going to do some simple Monte Carlo simulations. And if you took, for instance, Leo Kadanoff's wonderful course here, you can try to model most of the partition functions that you went through and set it up and actually evaluate the partition function in a very clever way using Monte Carlo techniques. That's all based on classical statistical mechanics. So of course, what we're going to end with is to look at, well, suppose we didn't do a classical statistical model, but we looked at a quantum mechanical model. Then if you listen to the lectures here, then there's something with a path integral. And you can actually discretize this path integral, and you arrived at what we call quantum Monte Carlo. And there are many ways of doing quantum Monte Carlo, and they actually vastly differ. What I'll be looking at is what's called worldline Monte Carlo, just because it's a very nice illustration of how you take a path integral and try to evaluate it. So that's roughly the outline. We'll start with something that's very simple, and then we'll speed up, and then approach light speed at the end. Hopefully not. The great thing about teaching a course like this is that we'll do whatever we do, and there's no real stress to do everything here. So maybe we'll just jump over something here. Depends a little bit on what you feel like. You're very welcome to let me know if something is too simple or something just went totally past you. Okay, are there any questions about this?
What we're going to be doing? Because if not, then I'm just going to jump right into it and tell you about Fortran. And I always have the intention of showing live programs on the computer, but I apologize, I never get around to actually taking the time to doing that. So I'll be writing actual programs on the blackboard, and I will attempt not to write them incorrectly. But if you doubt, then you can just type them into your laptop and then feed them to the compiler. Okay, so I'll be using quite a bit of closing. Actually, not too much. But there are a few things that I'll be talking about on. And so let me just get those out of the way. I'll be talking about compile time errors. And, well, as the name says here, these are errors that can be detected at compile time. Okay, it's very logical. So I hope that you're familiar with the fact that the way programming works is that you develop your program in a little file, use an editor for that. We're not going to talk about this at all. Then you feed it to a compiler. So the compiler is a program that will actually translate your source code into usable machine instructions. That's what you might think. We'll talk a little bit more about what actually happens later. But there are these compile times errors, and those would be the error that the compiler can detect when it's reading your program, right? It would be looking at your file, going through it, and then it would say, oops, something here is inconsistent, it can't be that way. That's as opposed to runtime error. So a runtime error would be that you try to actually execute the program here, and then it fails. Now that's very bad because it could be failing after maybe 30 hours running on the tray. To actually debug that is horribly painful. It has occurred to me many times that it's something that you, your frustration will grow as fast as you can. The box,
sort of, even worse error here is that the, let's just line it here, that the results along the,
okay.
Now, you can probably imagine that the reason that the results here are wrong,
they're basically infinite. So the reason why I'm telling you this is that obviously here when you look at this, it would be just terrific
if we could have the compiler find all the errors that we made in the program before we executed. It should seem obvious. So when I tell you about Fortran and you're asking me, well, why do we do this? The answer in almost all cases is because people figured out that, well, if we change the language in this and that way, it allows us to move an error that occurred at runtime up so that the compiler can actually detect it. And in the early days, this was not really possible because the actual factor of compiling the program was incredibly expensive. So one tried to save time there and make some shortcuts here. But that's the general idea here. Shift the detection of errors up as far as you can, as early as you can get them, and in particular have the compiler detect them. So we'll see quite a few of them shortly. Okay, so the other thing I want to tell you about is that there is such a thing as a runtime system. And I'm not going to tell you what it is, but once in a while I'll be referring to it. And it's the program that will actually take whatever the compiler has produced and execute it on the computer for you. So that's one way to think about it. But in particular, what it does, it handles input and output to your program. It will handle memory allocations. And various other things. So if your program is interacting externally with the computer, then it goes through a layer that we would call the runtime system. So most notably here, the memory allocation here, it actually has two components here. One that's called the stack, and then one that's called the heap. So the stack here is a linear growing segment of the computer memory. And whenever you make a call to sin of x, maybe not sin of x, but your subroutine or function or whatever, a so-called frame here is put on the stack. The thing I want you to know here is that this is usually a fairly limited memory space. And that's going to come in and be important at some point. In particularly, this afternoon, you'll be working with a little routine that does recursive calls. So you have a function that can call itself many times. And that will mean that this stack here will be growing under execution. The heap here is big. So what you need to know is that if you want to declare something that is humongously big, you need to somehow be able to put it on the heap. And that is usually not explained in the Fortran standard or anywhere else, but it's one of the intricacies that you come by when you start programming. Okay, how many of you guys have written computer programs before? Oh, okay. So how many of you have written Fortran programs before? Oh, okay, so there are a few of you here. So I hope what I'll be telling you is going to be useful, because quite often you're coming to Fortran from another program, from another programming language, and then you get totally disgusted because it doesn't work, and you're like, well, what is this? And that's because some of the design issues with Fortran was with totally different goals in mind than, for instance, a programming language like C or C++. So let me just show you the simplest Fortran program. And it's going to be very simple. And I'm hoping that you can type it in as we go along. So you have to give your name or your program a name, and I'll call this one Circle. And then you start here with program. So the keyword here is program. And then, of course, you have to end it. And you can actually end by just saying end here. But I would strongly recommend that you write end program circle. So the first thing you need to know here is that as opposed to many other programming languages, then upper lowercase here is the same. There's no way you can have Fortran really distinguish.
Is this only the same for functions, variables, up and lowercase?
Yes. You can't really have Fortran distinguish between upper and lower. And if you have programmed in C, well, I shouldn't. Somebody cooked up a compiler that could do it for you. But it's not in this. It's not in the Fortran standard. If you come from C and C++, this is, of course, a source of huge frustration, because you get so used to distinguishing between variables by upper and lowercase. You can also see that I have my own weird way of using upper and lowercase. I sort of insert uppercase letters at random. It's just for show, really. There's no reason here. Okay, so program in program here. If you have programmed in or heard about Fortran before, then the basic program may not look at all like this. So the source code format in Fortran has been heavily modernized, and you can write now what's called free format. And you should not even know about the constraints in old Fortran, except for when you. I'll perhaps show you some old Fortran code, and it doesn't look pretty, but it was very efficient. The next statement you should have here is implicit none. So that's, again, one of these things that I should tell you about. When Fortran was first designed, then people decided, oh, let's save some time, so that when I use a variable, I don't have to declare whether it's a real or an integer. I just would look at the first letter it would start with. So if it started with I, it would be an integer, for instance. If it started with R, it would be real. And gee, that was really convenient. But it would just mean that at somewhere along the line, then you would confuse yourself, and you would be using a real variable that would start with n or something like this. And that was precisely one of the cases where it was realized, oh, this is not a good idea, because we would have runtime errors that we could have avoided if we bump this up. So of course, Fortran still accepts programs in the old ways, but when we write something like this, we're eliminating that. So this year means that all variables have to be declared. So I'll tell you a little story. This is your second lecture, right, Sayu? This was to be the first Mariner mission. It was intended to form a Venus flyby. Venus, you know, it's a planet, right? The vehicle was destroyed by the range safety officer 293 seconds after launch at 9:26 in the morning on the 22nd of July 1962 when it veered off course. The failure was apparently caused by a combination of two factors. Improper operation of the Atlas airborne beacon equipment resulted in a loss of data signal from the vehicle for a prolonged period. Additionally, the Mariner 1 post-fly review board determined that the omission of a hyphen encoded computer instructions in the data editing program allowed transmission of incorrect guidance signals to the spacecraft. There's actually, if you go on the internet and look at Mariner 1, there's a whole discussion of, and now urban legends as to what really was the course. But and you can actually go and look at the actual Fortran code for the guidance module here. What happened was the Mariner 1 was going up straight, and then it received erroneous data and thought it should make a correction. And the engineers knew that this was going to happen, so they had programmed into the code that it actually shouldn't make those corrections, but that part of the program had never been tested, and somebody had missed a hyphen in one of the data declarations. I don't know if that's actually true, but the claim is that that made for a variable that was not declared and would have been caught if they had put in an implicit non-statement, which you couldn't do in those days anyway. Anyway, the Mariner 1 made a correction and then sort of looped down. So faulty applications of the guidance commands made steering impossible and were directing the spacecraft towards a crash, possibly in North Atlantic shipping lanes or in an inhabited area. The destruct command was sent 6 seconds before separation, after which the launch vehicle could not have been destroyed. So don't laugh at this, right? That mission, I think, was $18.5 million in 1962 prices. I don't know what happened to the guy who... I'll have a few more of these anecdotes and.
There's nobody in it?
No, it was.
Mariner 1, right? 1962. Otherwise. Well, you wouldn't want to be sitting there pushing the button.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Does the tab have any significance in Fortran?
Not when, you mean this space here? Not when I do it. It used to be in the old days of Fortran, you had to leave 6 spaces there and actually numbering what was in those spaces because it was all running on these punch cards that you feed in. Talk to some of the old guys who used them, and then they would always tell you that they had a whole box of them, and then you accidentally dropped them and spent 3 weeks sorting them after this. So you can put in whatever spacing that you like here. So the way we would put in a comment is we would put an exclamation mark and then write something here. So we would write something like this. is always a good idea. Then the next thing we have to do here is I have to declare some variables, and the two variables I'm going to be declaring, I'll call them x and y. Okay. Again, unfortunately, there are several ways you can write this declaration. I strongly recommend that you just write the type here, and then you have two colons, and then you write your variable names. So in this case, x and y. And we'll come back to all the other fun things that you can do here. Then I want to contact the runtime system, or I want to rename a value for x. And the way I'm going to do it for now is that I'm just going to write read here, and then **, and I'll come back probably tomorrow to tell you what the ** here is. It just means that I'll be reading from the standard input in list format, as it's called, and I'll write it or read it into the variable x here. Right. So then I can set y here. I can set that equal to the square root of 1 minus x squared. That's the only thing I could come up with last night here. And then maybe you want to print out what you want to print out what value y has. Okay, so this is the simplest program that you can ever really. Okay, so it should be a square root here. This is the simplest program that you really think about. So it has two components here. This is called the declaration part, obviously. And this here is the rest of the lecture behind it. These are executable statements. Okay, are there questions about this point? You see the yellow line here? Do some declarations here. They always have this structure here, real, two colons, x and y. Okay? Yeah?
Is there any difference if you write statements on the same line? Differentiate them?
Yes, unfortunately there is. If you're used to, for instance, C, then it has an abundance of these semicolons. Fortran, you can also use semicolons in Fortran if you want to have two statements on the same line. But otherwise, the general idea is that there's one complete statement per line. And of course, you can continue on the next line if you put in ampersands here. So that's the continuation symbol. But usually it's actually something that you don't use very much. The other thing that you really want to do when you start programming the first time around is that you want to develop a scheme here for indentations. So you can see that you want to be able to match this here with the end program, and that means that you should, for the bulk of the program, indent it slightly. And that just means that it becomes incredibly more readable. I don't have any particular preference for how this is done, and I would just encourage you all to develop a style of doing this so that you can read your own that you can read your own code here. So I just want to have so if we look first at the declaration type, then I put in the fact here that I can have reals here. And So, for instance, I could have a decoration which is just the real and then X. But I can do something that is
quite clever. I can give X here, I can give it attributes. So I can declare it as a parameter, in which case I have to tell the compiler and the program what that value is. So here I actually declared a constant. And this is, of course, very useful because it means that if later on in your program you decide to have a statement that X is equal to 3.0, the compiler will be able to catch that. This here is going to, this here is called an attribute. And there'll be quite a few more, actually. And you can guess some of them already, I guess. The other things that you can do here is that I can have another real, and let's call it Y. And we can set that equal to 2.0. This here would mean that the variable is initialized. And it would be only at startup, not at subsequent executions. So I can initialize my variables. That's sometimes useful. Let's just I'll just mention the other variables that we can have. I can have an integer here. Let's call it I. Yes, I'll call it little I here. I can have a character, and I can set the length of that character and actually declare a little array of them by specifying how many I want. So I can do character and then say something like this, that the length is equal to 3. So this here would give us what we would call a small string. A character can, of course, just have one character in there. The sort of last basic type is the logical. Yep.
It's short for length. So it just means that I have an array with 3 characters in it. So it could be basically one, two, web,
right? Only 3 characters. So this is the maximum number of characters you can get in a variable.
In this variable, right? But I can, of course, pump it up, so I put in 80.
And that's a variable called small string.
Yeah. What?
That's a variable called small string.
Yeah, now I should call it small string anymore.
Longer string.
Let's call it. Let's call it 3 here. So then I could set the way it would work is that I would say small string here, and I could set it equal to.
Is it possible to have strings with a variable length?
We'll talk about that tomorrow. So you can. You do all kinds of things here. The last remaining, so these are just the basic built-in
types that you have. The one that I wanted to really point out is complex. And there's nothing particularly about it. It just gives you a complex number. But this was designed into Fortran from the definition in 1958. So Fortran does complex numbers incredibly well. Everything that you expect, you can take formulas from complex analysis and just type them in and it works. That would hardly be the case in most other programming languages that I know of. And it's actually often one reason why you're forced to work in Fortran here. these days, if you go and work with C++, it also does fancy classes that will do complex numbers for you. Somehow, it never really is as logical as it is in Fortran. But OK. So yeah. How we assign complex value to it. So I can set here, I can set it equal to 1, 0, and then 2, 0. So that would be the real part here. I would set it equal to 1.
And the imaginary part would set it to 2, 0. But multiplication of complex numbers, functions of complex numbers, everything that you expect from mathematical analysis, it works wonderfully well. So let me just over here say that these days in Fortran, I can also do what I call divide types. So in my declaration part up here, I could actually declare a new type. I could say that my type here would be a measurement. So I give it a name, and then of course I have to end it with something. And then what I can stick in there is maybe a real here, which would be the pressure or something, and then an integer, and that could be the measurement number. So if I go over here and look in my declaration part, then over here, so I need to insert this before I use it, then I would say type measurement here, and again two colons, and then I would say T1, and then you can see that I would need to then be able to assign values to the internal parts of this combined type that I declare. And Fortran, they should have taken over the way it's done in C++ because it was sort of defined up C++, but they wanted to be different. So you do T1 here, and then percentage, and then you do, for instance, measurement number, and you set that equal to 1. And equivalently, I can set the pressure here, I can set it equal to 10. So you can, once you have these derived types here, you can, of course, do fancy things with them, and we'll look at that. I think the first homework is on the excellent of the, yeah.
Implicit none in there, just to say, or does it not?
Not at this point, because this here is just an explanation to the compiler what I mean by the type measurement. But you definitely want to keep it. So I forgot to put it here, so there should be an implicit none here, because it's going to tell me that if I try to access a variable T2 that I haven't yet there yet.
I have two questions. One, you've written various numbers with decimal points and 0.0. Is that any reason for that, or is that like, does it matter whether you put 10 or 10.0?
That's sort of one of the questions that you. It shouldn't matter, but in some cases, it will do. It will make a difference, and I'll tell you about that Wednesday.
Okay.
So it's not entirely, I'm actually going to look a little bit at the internals of how you, this here, of course, you can see if I just write 1 here, it means that I'm talking about an integer. 10.0 here means that I'm probably talking about real numbers. So underlying this is whether I'm going to be doing type conversion. And if you're familiar with C or C++, then you might have heard about CAS or implicit type conversions, and I'll tell you a little bit about that tomorrow. But for the moment, we're just going to assume that none of these things matter yet.
The question is, if you're trying to give assign a value to your new derived type, can you do it the same way with parentheses like that you do for complex?
Yeah, I believe you can.
So you can just, if it has like 7 parameters, you can just do a parentheses and all the values for all 7.
Yeah, just by the measurement and then of these variables. You can look at the exact syntax of this, right? That's, I believe, just by measurement, and then so you can say t1 here equal to measurement, and then you write it here in the, as a comment of the string.
Okay.
Yeah. If you don't initialize variables, is the compiler going to catch it? Or is that going to be on time?
Well, you're talking about initialize.
I don't initialize it, but then I use it. I can find my I, and then I say I equals like this one.
Yes and no. There is a way of telling the compiler that it should find it. And I'll show you that in probably 10 minutes. When should I actually stop on one? Is it 15 minutes or 20 minutes? Yeah, what do you...
Does the type block go inside the program block or outside of it?
It would be here in the declaration part before the executable statements, and notably before you use it.
Yeah. I noticed that syntax there, t1 equals measurement, is suggestive of a constructor. Is there any way to specify your own constructor for
it? So you can write, if you like C++ classes, you can pick them in Fortran. It's not as neat as it is in C++. And for those homework, you're going to be writing a little class that will do something very useful. And you can, of course, define your own constructors. In Fortran 2003, they have defined something that's called a class, which is slightly different. Most of the object-oriented features in Fortran that we combine, they sort of look like a formatted version of C++. Because they very carefully looked at C++ and then said, well, if we try to implement this, what is the performance penalty going to be? Okay. So now you know how to write a simple program that just has a declaration part and then followed by some statements here. So what we're going to... What we're going to do now is that we're going to then say, well, maybe I want to have a function. Well, maybe you want to write your own Fortran function for doing Fourier transforms or whatnot. There are actually several ways that you can write a function. I'm going to tell you my way of doing it. And it's sort of either my way or the highway, I'd say. You should try to follow what I suggest. So you would just start with the keyword function. And if you write this in a program file, you could have your initial program here. And then you would just follow that with the code for your function. So by tradition, the first function that you write is always called fun. Of course, it's incredibly fun. So you can see that there's something missing here because a function would actually return something. And the way we, or I recommend doing that is that we tell it that whatever the function is going to be returning is going to come in a variable that we call value. Okay. If you have seen Fortran code before, you'll see that quite often they'll be preceded with integer or real, so it would be written integer function, implicitly saying that that function would be returning an integer. I don't really do that much anymore because quite often it might be returning a derived type here, and it just becomes unwieldy if you write it here. So I prefer explicitly saying that it's going to be returning the result in the variable value here. And then we need to declare what these two things are, right? So what we would do here is that, for instance, our real here, or our variable, which is often called a dummy argument, as opposed to the actual argument that you will be calling the function with, right? So we could have something like this. And then I'm going to tell you one other attribute, which will sort of come back to what you were just asking here. I can tell it, the system, that my intention for the variable x was that it was an input parameter. So again, the name of the game is, if I do this, I don't have to, but if I do, then I can probably catch a lot of errors here. You look mystified. If I do write something like intent in here, then the variable cannot be modified in the function. And it has to have a useful value on entry. So that's something that can be checked. For instance, if you write a function for the cosine of x, it would perhaps not be desirable that that function change the value of x when it returned. And you can control that by doing just saying here that the intention for that parameter or dummy argument was that it should be intent in here. Then maybe our function here, it's going to be returning another real here. So we have to tell it that our return variable value, it is a real. So, yeah.
Are you inside of x, or are you passing the variable x?
Are you passing? Does the function get the pointer to the variable x?
I'm just going to tell you about that in 2 seconds. So the short answer is that Fortran is always what's called call by reference. And this is one of the huge confusions that come from C, which always does call by value, unless you tell it not to. In Fortran, there's hardly any way that you can do what's called call by value, and I'll tell you why in a few seconds. Okay, you could say, well, if I have intent in here, then maybe I should say that my intention for value here is that it should be the output. It's actually, if you do this,
this is flagged as an error here. Because you have already set here that value is a return variable. So it get confused if you declare it explicitly and then they decided, well, the compiler should say, oh, well, make up your mind. Was that some error or was it on purpose that you did this? So if I look at intent out here, it just means that variable here is undefined
on entry. So for instance, if I have another real here, which might be y, I cannot say y equal to value. I have to define what value, what's in there before I can assign it to something. So this here, it won't work. Because an entry, a variable that is intent out is undefined before I assign something to it. And then, of course, it has to be assigned the value before exit, right? So if I end my function, which of course I have to at some point, by writing end function fun here, then the compiler, since it knows that value here is a return value, it's going to flag and tell me that there's an error here because I didn't assign a value to value. Should call it something else. So the value here would be 2.0, then I'm fine, right? If I don't have something like this, then it's gonna complain. So this is you can control a lot of the behavior in terms of input of output to functions with these intent in and out. Yeah.
A couple questions. One is result the keyword indicating that, or is that
it's a keyword in this context?
Second, is there tuple output? I mean, can you assign multiple, right? Can you declare multiple return values?
Not for a function, but so usually functions are very simple. The next structure I'm going to be telling you about is a subroutine. And once you get going with subroutines, then it turns out that you can actually almost write all your functions as subroutines. So a subroutine wouldn't really have a return value, but it might have eight dummy arguments. And I could declare five of them intent out, two of them intent in, and so forth.
But
the basic function here, you only have one result.
No tuples.
So it here, of course, when I go back to the main program, then I would write that set here it would be equal to fun here 2.0.
Yeah. But if we can have multiple inputs, and if it's if I'm not mistaken, if we just modify those inputs, then those values get modified for the rest of the program as well. So in effect, we can modify more than the function can return more than
one thing. But it's not a return value in the sense that I can have it on the other side of the assignment statement. So if you do leave out this intent in here, then you can play around and modify x here. It's conceptually not the way that you're supposed to be thinking about functions. So I wouldn't recommend doing that.
Is it is that error then to not it to fail to assign to an intent out, or is that part of time? Does it take a path analysis to figure out
if you declare intent out, you can class at file time.
Oh, cool.
Which is
which means every code path has to have politically that has to politically the problem.
So, and it's some of the recent additions to Fortran Lightning that we increased. Let me just, I guess I should end at some point, but I just want to tell you that usually what you would be doing is that you would have you would have written your little function here that would do something incredibly clever. And then, of course, you want to call it from the main program and do assignment statements just by that issue. However, you would put this here in a separate file. And then usually, you would compile them separately. And that would mean that we would somehow have to tell the main program here about the function bug here. So we would have our program here, and let's call it test. And then we would perhaps have a real x, y, test here. But I would like to tell the main program about the function. Again, for the purpose that it would allow the compiler to figure out if I'm calling that function incorrectly. So, and it's perhaps not an entirely elegant way, and I'll tell you about better ways of doing this shortly. We have to declare the interface explicitly in the function. On the main program, and it's done fairly simply because I just take whatever the first lines of my function here is and repeat it over the main program inside what's called an interface declaration. So I would write here function of x here and the result value, and then I would like real here and the intent in that would be x, and then I would say real here, that would be my value. I don't really have to tell it by local variables, but so you then do int function fun, and you would write int interface. So this here is what's called an explicit interface. And of course, guess that the first Fortran standards didn't have anything like this. So you would just compile your function separately, you would compile your program separately, and then you would cross your fingers, legs, and arms that the parameters matched not even in type, but just in number. Some library routines in Fortran will have over 18, 25, arguments, and you'd be sitting there counting them. So if you do make an explicit interface declaration, then the compiler can check it knows about this function, and it can check that you're calling it correctly. So this is highly recommended. Of course, if you have loads of these functions, you might actually stick these little interface declarations into a file, and then use what's called an include file. So in your main program, then you write include, and then the file name where you have all these interface declarations. So the first time around, maybe you want to declare an explicit interface like this. I'll show you an easier way of doing it.
Can you define two functions with the same name but different arguments?
Yes.
Yes. I'll show you that.
The first question is, does the interface block have to accept the program block? Second question is, why? So we declared in the program variables x, y, and z, which happen to be the same as the ones in the function. Do we have to do that? And is it open?
No. Like, no, whatever this document is, this dummy document here, you can give it any name that you like.
Okay. So we're
this has to do with scoping, as yes. It's called, and I'll tell you about that probably tomorrow. X, Y, and C here is just my limited imagination. I couldn't come up with better ways. It has to go in the declaration file. For optimization reasons, Fortran doesn't allow you to mix in declarations with your executable statements. All these things here, of course, you can see that this is not going to be compiled, and it will not result in any machine code being produced. All this is just information for the compiler. So it's literally going to go out the window when the compiler produces actual source code.
So the role of this then is to tell it what you expect to be drawing into your program, what you expect to be linking against.
Yes.
Okay.
So the great uses of this is that you go and buy a commercial library that has a few thousand functions in it, and they will also provide you with a little include file with the appropriate interface declarations.
The other question is then, can you put multiple explicit interfaces, or do they have to appear in one interface block?
No, you can have as many as you want. Typically, you would be, if you have many functions, then it would just be one interface. They don't all have to be other.
So what does the interface care about this variable y, which is internal to the function?
It doesn't.
So that
you can leave this one out.
Okay.
Because you can just see that this is very very hands on. All you want is just to tell the compiler that when I call that function, then I have to call it that way.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that you can rename X and values, whatever you like in the interface. It doesn't have to have the same variable names when you actually define the function.
Sure. There's no particularly reason that you want to not use.
You want it to look the same. Yeah.
By definition, a function, a variable is always called X.
Yeah. And likewise, you lose nothing by removing the intent statement in the interface.
What?
You lose nothing by removing the intent statement in the interface.
This one is not supposed to be there. It was just because I told you about intent
within the interface block. It says real intent and X.
Yes. And so this one it shouldn't be there because it says here that it will be flagged as an error because. Value here is implicitly always intent out.
So within the interface block, it says real intent in X.
Yes.
Can that intent be erased without losing anything?
Oh, so that's what we mean. Well, so the answer to that is if you leave it out here, then everything will compile. But you then lost the possibility to be checking for assignments to value X here. So you're going to crash the program.
Even if it's set in the implementation of the function, where the checking is actually done.
All this is stripped out. Like, you're going to get a library which will just have binary code here and put the library function. When they compiled it, they made sure that the variable X here was not modified.
Right. But I mean, we can't variable modify from the outside. So that doesn't provide any additional checking to put it as a base as well. I mean, I recognize it makes the code clear.
Well, you want to do it. See, maybe not with intent in here, but in particularly with intent out, things become thorny. Because if you left that out here, then I could be calling the function, and it would be allowed to call it with a variable that I declared parameter as a constant. And then you would go over in your function, and then you would try to assign values to something that you declare a constant. And, your guess is as good as mine as to what's going to be happening, then it's not going to be pretty. So what you always want to do here is that you literally have to copy what is here. Gives sort of a nasty bookkeeping problem, because you have to have the file with the interface declaration and the actual function here, you have to have them matched completely. And that is maybe not optimal. I think we should stop here. Yeah.